Please stand clear of the doors.
Welcome to the Trombone Retreat, podcast of the Third Coast Trombone Retreat. Today on the podcast, we welcome Vanessa Frelick, Associate Principal Trombonist of the Toronto Symphony Orchestra. My name is Sebastian Vera, and I'm joined by my pal, Nikki Pop Schwartz. How you doing today? Have you played your scales yet?
I was playing my scales as we signed on to do this intro. Got some scales in, went to the grocery store. It's been a good morning. How are you doing?
In middle school, when you didn't pass your scales, they put you in scale jail. It's a place you don't want to be, in the clink.
In the clink.
Doing some hard time.
Doing hard time for my F major.
I'm doing just fine, and we had a really fun talk with Vanessa. I like her. She's cool. She's our first and definitely not last Canadian guest. And she just had some really great wisdom and advice, and also really hates Tim Horton.
Yeah, well, you know, we learned some reasons why to hate Tim Horton, so I guess I can't blame her, but those are some delicious maple logs you can get there, so I'm torn.
If you haven't subscribed to the podcast, please subscribe. You can subscribe. You can subscribe anywhere that you can download podcasts. We'd also like to announce our weekly Trombone Retreat live on Instagram. Thursdays at noon Eastern, Nick and I will be meeting on Instagrams to talk about certain specific topics, special Q&As, in general being ridiculous.
We also, for about a month now, we've been doing the daily Trombone Retreat practice hang all weekdays, 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern time. Go to tromboneretreat.com/practice. Hey, Sebastian. I heard some news.
Tell me the good news.
I heard the Houghton Horns now is carrying the Joe Alessi model of shock trombones. Exactly.
You know, I've been told that if you buy the custom Joe Alessi Shires trombone, that you will inherit all of his abilities.
Well, then I better buy that trombone.
Who knew? That's all you had to do.
Yeah. As you might have guessed, this trombone was fully designed by Joe Alessi himself.
And it embodies a perfect balance of color efficiency and resonance, and has unsoldered two-piece lightweight yellow brass bell, which enables you to effortlessly cut through any ensemble while maintaining a mature width of sound. Financing options are available through Houghton Horns, and you can also visit their showroom. For more information, visit houghtonhorns.com. Enjoy the podcast!
So how you been, Vanessa? Last time I saw you was at ITF in Muncie.
Yeah, in that weird auditorium. Blasting away.
do you remember being in there and there was that one girl trying bass trombones? There was this girl trying bass trombones, and she would, if you could imagine, there's the exhibition hall. It was like in the lobby area of an auditorium, and then you could walk into the auditorium and try the horns. And this girl would go and pick up a bass trombone, come into the auditorium, play a note at minimum 17 fortes, and be like, nah, this isn't it, and go put it back and grab another one. And Vanessa and I were trying to have a conversation, and it wasn't going well because we were being covered by trombone.
Well, and you wanted to listen. It was, like, impressive in a way.
It was. It was very loud. It was very loud.
You just described why I typically avoid certain trombone events.
So, what's new?
are we in the interview now?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's happening.
Okay. Before you even realize.
What have you been doing since I last saw you in 2019? I mean, besides doing nothing like the rest of us.
Yeah, for a while I was doing a lot, and lately I've been doing not so much. Just before COVID happened, things were chugging along. I was teaching at the University of Toronto, and playing with the symphony here in town and loving my job, and then everything ground to a halt. And since then, I've done a lot of canoeing and cross-country skiing, which are both new things to me. And
oh, man. I've always wanted to cross-country ski.
It's a workout. Yes.
It's like your whole body, right?
Yeah, I did 14 kilometers yesterday, and it's like you sweat through so many layers. It's crazy.
Now, how many freedom miles is that? No, so, okay, I always ask people this because I grew up cross-country skiing. First of all, were you on groomed trails or were you going
like yesterday we went to a place that has really nice groomed trails.
That's a lot easier.
Yeah.
See, I grew up
on a lot less falling.
Yes. Yeah, because it's really hard to cross-country ski on non-groomed trails. It really is. I grew up on the edge of a state park, and we would go back in there, and there were no groomed trails. And then I learned that way, and then I went to a place with groomed trails, and it's like, oh my God, this is so easy. But it's fun, isn't it?
I really need a lesson, but I started learning during COVID, so you can't get a lesson or you can't get rentals. So you just sort of invest in the equipment and then trial and error.
Is it easy to fall in cross-country skiing?
Yes.
All the time.
Hey, Nick, this isn't your interview. I'm asking
you. Hey, well, you're talking to two people who cross-country ski. In fact, I'm going to get mine out. I swear I'm going to get them out. But the boots are a little small, so we'll see. Maybe.
Let's have a cross-country ski trip. Like, let's meet in Vermont or something.
You know what's
if the clear? Border was open, I'd be there.
Exactly.
Well, first of all, help me out. Is it Frolic or Frelick?
Frelick.
Okay. Do you say that because it's like so people just won't spell your name like Frolic?
I can't imagine having a name that comes up in regular conversation all the time, like Nick. It must be really strange to just like, oh, I nicked my face shaving again.
Oh,
and you're always hearing your own name. So that only happens to me when people say the word finesse, and then I kind of do a double take. Are you talking to me? So I do find it a little strange when I hear someone say Frolic.
That makes me think, though, if your name was Finesse Frolic, that'd be like the best dancer name ever.
Sure, we'll say dancer, yeah.
I mean, yeah, I've been following you on Instagram and seeing you do these crazy, like, backwoods adventures. That's pretty admirable to keep yourself busy doing those beautiful things during this time. You know, it's better than sitting and doing a Netflix binge, you know?
Well, it's extreme social distancing.
Sure.
It's one of the few things that you can do that's safe right now, that's permitted. I think in Ontario here, like, I think our numbers at their worst were still, like, I think the only states that were doing better than us were maybe, like, Hawaii and Vermont. And yet we have some of the strictest restrictions of anywhere. So, like, currently we can only have 10 musicians on stage at one time. So there's really no possibility of doing much of anything, and definitely nothing that involves trombones.
Unless you do like the Stravinsky Octet or something like
that. Yeah. Which somehow they don't seem keen to program. So yeah, I got into kind of exploring what wilderness and nature there is around here, which turns out there's a lot. I'll go and map my trips afterwards on Google Earth, and I'm expecting to see this giant route that I took, and it's the tiniest little percentage of Ontario that I've seen.
Well, you just gotta zoom in a lot.
A lot.
Yeah, and then it'll look huge. Yeah.
It's so huge, this province.
I know.
Well, speaking of some live performing, I want to hear about this group Horn on the Cob.
You've done your research. So my partner is a horn player in the orchestra with me, and one night we were sitting and having cocktails early in the lockdown in March, and we heard brass playing coming from outside, and we're Toronto, so that's significant because it's pretty cold outside, and it sounded very close, so we got off our Zoom cocktail hang and went running out into the street to see where it was coming from. And they had just stopped and gone back in their house, but it turned out it was this family where the dad is an amateur trombonist. He's a playwright by trade. And his sons were in grade 8 and I think at the time 11, maybe 7 and 11 respectively. And they had just kind of by fluke brought their instruments home for March break, which is like our spring break. And one of them had been playing trombone, but had just brought home a tuba for fun. And the other one had just started learning trumpet. And so the dad decided, okay, to give these guys something to do, we're going to write a little arrangement. And instead of what most people were doing at the time, which was the 7 p.m. go out and bang pots and pans and cheer for healthcare workers, we're going to play a little song. And so I think they did a really short arrangement of the theme song for the A-team. And so we called them back out of their house and talked to them a bit. And we said, are you going to do it regularly? They said, yeah, we're going to try and do it every night. So we asked if we could join. And he said, well, do you guys play? And we're like, yeah, we play. So we said we were in the symphony. And they said, yeah, come anytime. And we went out the next night. And it ended up being 108 nights in a row. And between mainly the dad and his oldest son, a few were mine, but mostly it was theirs. They wrote a new arrangement every single night. And we ended up being joined by a couple of trumpet players that moved in across the street, and then a few jazz players from nearby. And it went a little bit viral, but we never gave the location or the street name because we wanted to keep it to just the local neighborhood and just people that happened to wander by at that time. And it kind of became a really great bonding, bringing the neighborhood together experience. And people were really appreciative. And of course, we were so, like, it really got us through that period. It gave us a reason to get out of our pajamas once a day at least, or at least put a coat on over them.
Yeah.
and go down and play some music. And it was pretty amazing, especially for the young guys in the band.
Oh, yeah.
To read a new chart every day. I don't think there's a lot of middle schoolers that have that experience and perform it every day. So they ended up both getting pretty serious about their instruments and taking lessons. And we met a lot of people in the we were new to the neighborhood, actually. So we got to meet a lot of people that we live
now
near.
Everybody knows you.
Well, now we moved away again because... Oh. The one person that did not appreciate it was our upstairs neighbor, sadly.
Oh,
oh
no.
Really?
So, yeah.
So that's what drove you out, is you had an angry neighbor?
Yeah, she really... It wasn't just the music. She was a bit... She didn't even like that we were gardening in the backyard or that she could hear us talking. So with the instruments, it just got to the point where she was blasting heavy metal every time we tried to play. And we just had to get out of there.
And what's her name?
Yeah.
She lives at...
Yeah, no kidding. That's really, I hate hearing stories like that.
Yeah. So many of them. It's really hard in this city because there's not a lot of, well, it's very expensive to live. So like I'm still renting and there are not a lot of single family homes. There's a lot of duplexes in Toronto. So even if you buy a whole home, it's often a semi-detached for what you can afford. And so you still have to luck out with the neighbor situation in that case.
Now, is it common to live like that, or are there like a lot of like mid-rises, high-rises, stuff like that too?
There are a lot of condos, yeah, a lot of condo buildings, more and more. And it's kind of frustrating. Toronto's, like a lot of Canada, doesn't do a very good job of preserving its past. And it's very different from, that's why I loved living in St. Louis, because you still have all of these amazing buildings that from every era that have been preserved and are still used and still cherished, and a lot of businesses that are still going from the 50s. And Toronto's just all new all the time. Tear it down, build a condo.
It's unfortunate to hear about your neighbor, because it kind of confuses me, because it kind of goes against my belief that all Canadians are the nicest people on the planet. Which I don't, I'm trying to, you know, of course there's stereotypes that go both ways, and that it's a positive stereotype, but literally every Canadian I've ever known has been like over the top friendly person, and I don't get it at all.
Go to
but
a hockey.
They're masters of passive aggression.
Oh, yeah. Is that what it is?
We're nice to your face.
You have see. I think I understand the Canadian mentality more, being from the Midwest, because it's. I think it's a similar mentality of passive aggression. Because everyone says, "Oh, people from the Midwest are so nice," and I'm like, they're nice to your face. like get a couple of old fashions in them and they'll really know what they think. That reminds me of a story. When I first moved into my apartment that I live in New York right now, I've lived there with my wife for going on 9 years. And when we first moved in, I get a knock on the door one day. I'm practicing. It's like 7 at night. And I'm like, uh-oh, here we go. And it's my downstairs neighbor. And she's this older lady. And she was like, hi, we were wondering when your wife is going to get home. Cause like, we like hearing you play, but we like hearing her play the piano a lot more. And I was like, oh, that's not at all what
Ouch.
I expected. Yeah. So I said, I'll tell her to practice more. Okay.
So St. Catharines, Ontario, the Garden City. I looked up some pictures of this place and it looks like a little fairy tale land to grow up in. I mean, of course, all the photos on Google are probably the best photos, but it looks like a beautiful town to grow up in.
It's okay.
It's okay.
It's fine.
Wow.
So really? we're not going to ask you to be the spokesperson for your hometown.
Okay, obviously it was traumatic. Let's skip over that. Did you grow up there your whole life?
Yep, I lived in the same house my whole childhood, and my parents still live there. And I have 4 siblings younger than me, and most 3 of them still live there as well, or nearby.
Big sister.
Yes, that's so if I'm ever really bossy to you in a section, that's why. I'm sorry.
you're the responsible one, though.
Yes.
I mean, it's got to be a nice place to grow up. I mean, you're not far from the falls, right? And you're. It seems nice to me. I guess it's everything. Grass is always greener, no matter where you grow up, right?
Yeah, it was great. I'm happy. I prefer living in the bigger city for sure. But it was great. I had, you know, my parents are both brass players, and I grew up going to Niagara Symphony concerts.
Where do they play?
Well, this is a bit embarrassing, but trombone and French horn.
Oh.
Except my dad's the trombone player.
Yeah, Freud would have something to say, huh?
Yeah.
So when did you get into the trombone? It sounds like we know how you got into the trombone, you know, through the family and going to concerts, like you just said, but...
Well, my dad was actually my high school band teacher as well.
Oh, wow.
Both of my parents taught at the high school where I went.
So it wasn't a choice?
Apparently I chose it of my own free will. I was kind of a goody two-shoes kid in high school, so it was different for me to sit in the back row and goof around a little bit. So I think it was good for me and loved it right away. And I always loved music. I grew up going to music camp every summer, Niagara Symphony Summer Music Camp. And then later I worked there in high school and taught there. And music was, I just lucked out and had fantastic choir teachers and music teachers all the way through school. And I took piano lessons and I loved my piano teacher. So it was, I loved sight reading piano music, so I hated practicing, but I would just sit and read through, like, Disney piano books for hours, and it was always a fun thing for me, and I never thought about doing it as a career until I had to choose what I wanted to study in university, and I thought, well, I can't think of anything I'd rather spend my time doing, and I really didn't get serious about it until I did a recital in second year, and that kind of got me hooked because I really practiced for that and actually got a lot better faster and loved the experience of being on stage as a soloist and performing. And from then on, I took it a lot more seriously and started setting goals. And before that, it was like my first year, I went home for Christmas and set my trombone where we kept all the brass instruments under the piano and actually forgot to take it back to school because then I didn't touch it again for the whole Christmas break. And my dad dropped me off back at school, and then this is before cell phones, so it's 10 minutes after he dropped me off, I was like, oh my god, I am a trombone major. And he had to drive back to Toronto again and bring me my instrument. Not too bad.
Yeah,
that's Nick style.
You know, because I forgot my trombone to my very first trombone lesson I ever took. So that's
it happens.
Well, yeah,
it's not always the first thing on your mind.
Apparently not. Who were you studying with then? This is University of Toronto, right?
I actually studied with Jeff Hall, who's the bass.
Oh yeah, sure.
Well, in our orchestra.
It's come full circle for you then, huh?
Yeah. Well, I mainly studied with Jeff and with Gord Wolf. I took lessons on the side, so it was definitely. I had to flip a switch when I started working with them because we always had this very professional teacher-student relationship. And I don't know, I think I was raised to be very respectful to people in that sort of position. And so it was a big change to just go from that. Yeah, I guess just the distance that you have a little bit. Like, I didn't quite feel comfortable just joking around with them at first to working with them in the orchestra.
And now you know a completely different side of them.
Exactly.
Did they help facilitate that switch for you? Were they like really great about like, oh, come on, like lighten up a little bit. Like, we're colleagues now, or.
Oh, there's really no choice in that brass section. Oh. You just kind of,
okay.
You're just thrown in right off the bat. They're unabashedly themselves at all times, cracking jokes. And it's really fun.
when I joined the ballet, you know, at the time Ray Mace was the principal trumpet, and you know, he was Professor Mace to me. So I get to my first day at work and I was like, oh, I'm very happy to be working with you, Mr. Mace. And the whole brass section just started laughing. They're like, oh, Professor Mace, like making fun of him and all. And he was like, you have to call me Ray. Like, they will not let up if you call me Mr. Mace. So you said you got serious about the trombone your sophomore year of college. Were you really aiming for Juilliard, or was there other options, or like, how did you end up in New York?
I really didn't know what schools were out there at all. And I didn't know anything about any schools in the States. When I auditioned for university in the first place, U of T was like, that's got to be the best school I could possibly go to. And I didn't know any professional trombonists. And I remember it got to the point where people would be dropping names. So I finally just sat down and went online and made little charts of all the major players so that I could start to remember their names, because I had never heard of them or listened to them. And I had this teacher, I took a brass performance class that was only offered 1 year. It happened to be my third year at University of Toronto, and it was taught by the former principal horn player of the Canadian Opera Company, Joan Watson. And sadly, she passed away from cancer a few years back now. But it was like, it changed my life, this class with her, because she talked about all the stuff that no one else had, that I hadn't heard anyone else talk about, like goal setting, but not just about practicing, about all areas of your life and making goals really specific. I had a little goal setting session with her, and she said, what do you want? Where do you see yourself in 5 years? What do you want to be doing? And I said, I want to play in an orchestra. And she said, which orchestra? And I said, oh, any that'll take me. Like, I don't care. Anywhere. And she said, no, you have to pick a city. Where do you want to work? And so I said, Boston or Toronto. And it came true, you know, and she had kind of a special story where she played horn in the Victoria Symphony in Western Canada. And she said, I'm going to play principal horn in the Toronto Symphony. And everyone said, you're crazy, Joan. There's not going to be any openings there. She said, I don't care. That's what I'm going to do. And she just made that her goal. And she said she had cut out from a program, she had cut out a list of the names of the horn section, and she had it on her fridge, but with her name added. And so I did that before the Toronto Symphony audition too. And sure enough, I think there was some situation, someone retired early. I can't remember what the story was, but she ended up auditioning and winning the assistant principal horn job in the Toronto Symphony. And then from there, she went on to become principal horn in the Canadian Opera Company. And so she totally
failed at her goal then, principal.
Well, she played principal sometimes, so we'll count it.
It's like, we can't take anything she said seriously.
that's a great powerhouse. And,
yeah, no kidding. Wow.
Yeah, amazing woman. And so that really inspired me to set some goals that I might not have set, like to say, okay, I want to go to Juilliard. I want to study with Joe Alessi. And then I think if you set a goal that specific and that serious, and then just make sure that everything you do is with that kind of in the back of your mind. Like, is this something that is going to help me eventually reach that goal? Even if it's something really small, you have a much better shot of achieving it, especially because if you say, I'm going to Juilliard, if you say, I'm going to win a job in this orchestra, I'm going to run 10 kilometers, I think you can see yourself doing it rather than just saying, it would be cool to have an orchestra job.
I love that. So, I really do.
Yeah, that's
really cool.
So did that inspiration... So I'm curious, because you said growing up, you were more motivated by just enjoying music, it sounds like, and playing, and the actual practicing day-to-day maybe wasn't your favorite thing. So was there a point in school, and I imagine her influence was really profound on this, but like, was there a point in school when you had to face that reality of, okay, this is what I want to do, so I have to find some way to make a consistent work ethic? Was it the goal setting that really helped you with that?
I think so. And also, she was really big on putting a story to what you're playing. And, you know, she would say, okay, it's all well and good to judge people on intonation and articulation and sound quality and all these things that we consider important. But she would say the most important thing is the goosebump factor. If you're not giving somebody goosebumps, it doesn't matter. And so I think that also changed how I practiced, because I didn't really get for a long time how to put my emotion into music. Like, I think I did it a little bit naturally, but making that the focus really made practicing more fun. And then I think I had a good balance between her and my other teachers to also work on all the technical stuff. And I don't know, understanding that your emotional concept can be more clearly understood by the listeners if it's coming across really clearly. So if you have all that technical stuff under control.
Wow, that's awesome.
And I think the other important part of that is that when you're setting those long-term goals, they can change. Like, no goal has to be set in stone. So you can set these goals and then you don't have to be locked into them. They can morph as you grow.
Yeah, absolutely. So you were in New York. You were there for not even a full 2 years, was it?
Not even a full year, actually.
That's right. You went to San Antonio, right?
Yeah.
The official training orchestra of Juilliard students.
Yes. It seemed like.
There's so many. How was that experience down in San Antonio?
Oh, it was amazing. And I got that job totally thanks to Mr. Lewis Bremer. Mm-hmm.
Love Lewis.
We were at Music Academy of the West, which was one of the best summers of my life. And
why was it the best summer of your life?
Oh, we just had this great section. We had such a great time.
Who else was in the section?
Landris Bryant on tuba. And then Lewis Bremer on bass trombone. Paul Jenkins, who's now in Nashville.
Yeah.
And Doug Rosenthal.
Oh, great.
Oh, Dougie.
Who doesn't Dougie love Fresh. Doug?
Yeah. So we had a lot of fun as a section. And yeah, we had this tradition that when we drove, I don't know if you guys have been to Music Academy, but the place, yes. So the residence, you drive up that big hill.
Which isn't the residence anymore, by the way.
Oh, okay. Well, it just wouldn't be the same then. But you drive up this big hill. So we would have been out, going out after a concert or whatever, and or meeting up with one of your compeers, having some fancy, like the fanciest dinner you're ever going to be able to afford. And we would blast this. We had it timed. We would blast this Earth, Wind, and Fire Live at Velfare song, Fantasy. And we'd all just like sing along in the car and drive up the driveway and then show up where all the students were hanging out and partying and
yeah,
keep the party going.
I think Music Academy, everyone who goes to Music Academy, it's one of the best summers of their life. It's pretty awesome.
It's a beautiful place. Yeah. A great program.
It's like honeymoon capital of the country. That's what I've
the
always
what?
Been told. The honeymoon capital.
Yes.
And I feel like I know several couples who are still together who started at Music Academy as well.
Really?
Mm-hmm. But so Lewis came up to me one day and said, hey, are you sending in a tape to the San Antonio audition? And I said, what's San Antonio? Like, I had never heard of it. My U.S. geography was still really
what? You didn't know what San Antonio was?
Hey, hold on. It sounds like someone has forgotten about the Alamo. Okay.
Do you know what the Alamo is?
Now I do. Now I'll never forget.
It's not required in elementary school in Canada to learn about Texas history.
We have like 20 years of our own history that we spend a lot of time learning. So I really had never heard of even the place. And so,
that's awesome.
So he told me what was going on and I made this tape and I played it for him. And he said, you're going to re-record this, right? He said, you're going to do Heldenleben again, right? And Bolero. And I was like, okay. And then I won the second trombone job based on this taped audition because they had to fill all three spots at once.
Oh, so there was no live part.
There was no live part. So,
wow.
And they had just one set of excerpts for tenor trombone. And so Tony Wise was offered the first trombone spot and I was offered the second trombone spot. And then Lewis won the bass trombone spot. So we all moved to San Antonio and had a great year because we were all new and we all would get there early and warm up together and play excerpts every week and put on recitals. And yeah, I loved my time there.
So you got to experience warm weather and amazing Mexican food for the first
time. Well, also that was like the first time I'd had real Mexican food, aside from a little bit at Music Academy of the West.
Mm-hmm. And did you have barbecue made by Lee Hip?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Of course you did.
Every day that we had a double service, the tuba player Lee Hip would say, Like, I think the first couple times I brought my own lunch, and then Lee would just come up to us and be like, all right, here's where we're going to go for lunch today. And I would just kind of like put my little bag lunch, hide it, and he'd take us to some amazing local joint and order us secret things that weren't on the menu.
Yeah, I've had Lee hit barbecue in because he, I don't know if he still does, but he taught at Eastern Music Festival when I was a student there, and he would make barbecue like every other weekend, and it was awesome. I liked it a lot. Then from there, you're in San Antonio for what, 1 year?
Just 1 year. And then I was actually planning to return to finish my master's. And then I took the St. Louis 1 year audition because Steve Lang had just won Boston and got that. So, and then that turned into 3 years, which was really where I got my master's degree.
Yeah.
Was it so a series of 1 years there?
Yes.
How was that experience? How was playing in the St. Louis Symphony? How was living in St. Louis? Had you heard of St. Louis?
I think by then, yeah.
I'm totally kidding.
Barely.
Yeah.
I loved it. I've just been so lucky. Like, I've just had great colleagues every situation that I've been in, and great sections. And I hear these horror stories, and I know that it can be bad. So I'm so grateful for all the people that I've got to work with. So St. Louis was amazing.
So you say it was a grad experience. So like, what did you learn most going through that experience?
Well, I remember Mark Lawrence saying once at Music Academy when he was coaching us, like, all that really matters is articulation. Like, right before we went out on stage to play, I think, Mahler 7. He's like, just remember, all that really matters is articulation. So St. Louis was, like, kind of the embodiment of that statement. Like, just learning how to really play in the back row, how to, the kind of presence of sound you needed, and just, like, the edge that you could put on sometimes to make it work, and like learning what was enough, what was not enough, what was too much. And just like that section, that whole brass section is so solid. And I would often be playing assistant, and the way they set up, it was like a very back row in the middle of the stage with trombones and then trumpets. And then right in front of you, a row of French horns. And so it would often be, I'd be playing assistant, and I would have Tim Myers playing principal trumpet on my left. I'd have Tom Drake playing principal trumpet on my right. And then I'd have Roger Kaza playing principal horn right in my face. And it was just this little
wow.
Trifecta. And I'd just be like sitting there resting and soaking it all up.
I'm surprised. I mean, that's like my least favorite way to set up, with the horns right in front of you. And the horns usually hate it too. Do they? Yeah, they don't mind?
They've since changed their setup on okay. stage, actually.
Because we used to sit like that in the ballet pit, and it's like, it's just like constantly, it feels like fighting all the time. Mm-hmm. Not like personally, but just like yeah. sounds like meeting each other, you know?
But like young trombone player me loved it.
Of course. Yeah, I mean, there is something exciting when you
have... For the rest of your career, no thank you, but yeah.
Especially Roger Kaza playing in your face. He's a monster, you know?
Yeah. Well, the attention to detail. That was the crazy thing I learned from him. Like, even when we were sitting, we were so close, I could read his music sometimes. So I could see, like, all these accents and slurs and pencil markings, and he would get every single little thing.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Do you think, like, when you think about this... advice from Mark Lawrence about articulation. I lived in San Francisco for 4 years and I took a number of lessons with him. He talks about that a lot. And do you think that really played into the way you play, that you learned how to play, like you said, in St. Louis because of the hall itself? Because it is a very like reverberant hall, right? So that like you, like the clarity of the note is the most important part of it, right?
It's the hall, but it's also just the instrument. I think the trombone, the tenor trombone in particular. And I think Mark might also have said this, but the range, you're so mid-range. It's such a big orchestra, and a lot of what you do is just going to be for nothing if you don't have the articulation, making sure that that cuts through the texture and is heard. So even something soft, you need that little pop.
I agree wholeheartedly.
I prefer to air attack everything.
Air attack, yeah.
The poo attack.
The poo attack.
Has Nick ever told you his reverse articulation?
Oh,
I think so, actually.
I've mastered the reverse articulation. It comes from an inner quietude and peace, you know?
And then ends up the opposite
yeah,
of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Hot.
Yeah, hot. Yeah, hot articulation. When in your 3-year period in St. Louis did Toronto come open?
Well, actually, it came open like near the end of my first year, I think. And because the second drummer player was announced his retirement, and I actually took the, so in Canada, we for the most part still have a national round for most major orchestras. And there's a lot of debate right now as to whether we should keep having that.
On a national level, there's a debate, or in Toronto?
I think it's something that's discussed across the country, but like definitely in our orchestra, it's something that we talk about from time to time. And people,
how do you feel about it?
I like the idea of still having some sort of advantage for national players, but I can see how it's not very efficient when it comes to hiring. So,
well, I mean, how often do they, even if they have a really good candidate in the national audition, do they still like, oh, let's just be safe and like we'll just auto advance them?
Not very often. Like we have a history of hiring at the national round, especially in string positions. Our last, like if you look over our last 10 years, which I have done as part of the orchestra committee, we've hired quite regularly at the national round, and then a lot of time it goes international as well. And I actually didn't make it to the finals even at the national audition. And then I worked my butt off and came back a year later. Luckily, they didn't hire. They gave someone a trial. It didn't work out. And so they went international, and I got to come back and try it again.
So speaking of goals, when they first announced that audition, did your ears just perk up? I mean, was this something you were always envisioning?
Yeah. Yeah, I was ready. I wanted to take it, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like those auditions, like the ones that you like dream about, are the hardest, because like it's so easy to get in your own way mentally and just be like, I want this so bad, and just, you know, freak out about it. So like,
yeah.
I wonder, just out of curiosity, do you feel that having that first chance, not winning, did that kind of get out all the butterflies and all that stuff and say, okay, now it's time to now I think I can do this?
I think it always helps having experienced something once already.
Sure.
Because there's like the unknown just adds a lot to your, yeah, that's why I think people recommend like try to get a picture of what the hall looks like inside, so you're not walking out on stage and seeing it for the first time. I think it always helps that it's a little bit familiar. But what really helped was I just got a lot more serious about my mental preparation, and I did the online course offered through the Bulletproof Musician blog with Dr. Noah Kagayama, who's on faculty at Juilliard, I think. Mm-hmm. Now,
yep.
He's a Don Green disciple, and that really was a game changer for me.
Wow. Yes. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like what specifically were you, if you feel comfortable talking about it,
yeah,
what specifically were you battling, and what did this program help you with, and how did it help you?
Well, I'd been taking Inderal at auditions for a while, but I kind of eventually realized that it doesn't help at all if you're not also mentally ready, which I think is one more argument for it. Like it's not going to be this magic pill that makes you able to play better or even conquers your nerves. It just helps with the physical symptoms of them, but you still need to be managing that. And
can you imagine if there was a pill that just made you play better? That'd be sweet.
It's a movie with Bradley Cooper called Limitless.
sorry, continue.
There's probably pills that will make you feel like you're playing better.
That's for the after hours behind the Patreon wall hang.
Yeah. So for me, one big thing was just changing my self-talk from being sabotaging to being helpful. And just like realizing that, because especially after Juilliard, I was so self-critical, and you think you're doing what you're supposed to do when you're saying, nope, that wasn't good enough. No, that wasn't good enough. That sucked. And trying to get it better and better. But really, you can be actually sabotaging your own improvement and process if you're not. And so my kind of golden rule is like, don't say anything. I still break it all the time, but try not to say anything to yourself that you wouldn't say to a friend or a student, and just be a good coach to yourself, basically. And I was saying a lot of things that were definitely not things I would say to somebody else.
It's really easy, right? It sneaks in before you even realize it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I imagine it was a long process to even, like, I imagine the first step is just recognizing when you're doing it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's actually a huge part of it. Like, if you've done that, then it gets a lot easier.
So besides the mental side, you said you really put a lot of work in. Was it just mainly the mental side, or did you change anything in your process of just physically preparing?
I didn't really change how I practice, but I started playing for more people, getting more feedback, which I think is also a part of the mental side as well.
Sure.
And I played for violinists and like anyone that would spend 15 minutes listening to me play excerpts.
Right.
And you get a lot of interesting, like, there's still something that sticks with me that this violinist in St. Louis said about how to phrase through a dotted quarter note in a moll or five excerpt. But that I don't think I've ever heard a trombone player say. So it's interesting the things you get out of that.
Well, yeah, I think it's very interesting. I think a lot of, you know, it doesn't matter trombone or any other instrument. I think we tend to play for like instruments. Even if it's not trombone, we tend to play for trumpet players or horn players or tuba players. And they are, even if they're trying to be as objective as possible, there is so much just sympathy for the problems that we face. They understand.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, yeah. And they maybe mentally let some things slide. Whereas if you're playing for a violinist, they're going to be like, why did that note sound different? I don't understand.
Yeah. Why is your valve so loud every time you push it?
Exactly.
Like, trombone players never complain about that.
Yeah. But, we had a horn audition and it got down to the end and our music director was like, he empties his spit too loud.
That actually drives me nuts.
Well, I understand. But I was like, I mean, you could also just say, hey, could you empty your spit less loudly? Like, because it's not technically the playing. We're supposed to be judging the playing. But anyhow, yeah, there's all this stuff that comes into play when we play for other people. And that's a good way to kind of exercise the mental aspect, right?
And then energy regulation is the other thing. Like, I don't know if you guys have. Yeah. So like one thing that he talks about in this course is everybody has a different energy level that they perform their best at.
What's yours?
I think mine's somewhere in the middle. Like, I don't want to be too chill. I'm not one of those people at auditions that's just like got the headphones in and not talking to anybody else. I just want to feel kind of normal. And some people have to get themselves really amped up before they go out.
I have to say, I think I was thinking about when I was reading a little bit before this interview that I think I've had one interaction with you. It's just a vague memory. But I believe we were at the same audition once. I want to say it was Atlanta. I don't have you ever auditioned?
Yes. There? Yeah.
And you had, I think we were just, you had the warm-up room, a warm-up room that I was going to have right afterwards. And it's one of those things like you remember like a feeling or whatever. And I just remembered it was an audition. It's like a very tense atmosphere. And you were just the nicest person to me. Like, you were super patient. You're like, oh, yeah, let me get... And, like, you're smiling.
Eating
and
that
like,
Canadian myth.
Yeah. That doesn't sound right. Are you sure it was Vanessa?
No, but it just struck me because, you know, it was such a good attitude and energy to have in an audition. And
cool. I'm glad I was putting that out.
But it was all gamesmanship. You were just trying to get in my head, I'm sure.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Exactly.
But you mentioned, I wanted to circle back a little bit. You mentioned when you left Juilliard, you felt so much, you know, self-critique. And is it just the experience of going through a high-level environment like that and being around just really talented people that kind of fuels that sort of thinking? Was that difficult to navigate at times?
I think a lot of it was Joe's teaching. I mean, I think Joe's like a super caring, kind person, and I loved working with him, but he gets pretty intense in lessons, and you know, I'm pretty good at taking criticism, I think, like I'm at taking it in stride, at looking at it as something constructive, and you could see other people that just like weren't able to do that so well, but like even with always trying to do that, it can be, you can just get really hard on yourself. And then when at the same time you're taking auditions and always trying to figure out what you could have done better, what you could be doing better, it's a lot. So it took me a while to, you know, and really thanks to good friends and my partner at the time, like having people around you that are going to build you up. I think you need that in your life too.
Absolutely. You know, you've had a chance of a relatively rare opportunity to play in three, you know, great ensembles as a member. And what do you think that taught you, being able to experience different orchestras, the way they play? What did you take away from that experience?
Well, I hear people talk a lot about adapting their sound to play in different sections and like, okay, I'm going to audition for this orchestra. I should try to sound in this style. And like Chicago is somewhere that jumps to mind. Like everybody talks about how you have to play this particular way. And I don't know. I think if you're a good musician and you're listening, like you can adapt. It's the differences aren't that extreme. Like, I don't think that it's as big of a deal as some people make it out to be, to switch around. And there are definitely differences to how St. Louis and the Toronto sections played, but I think it's more important that you bring your own sound to that section and bridge your sound to their sound.
Yeah.
But you're part of that. So I don't think you should like hide in someone else's idea of what the sound should be.
Yeah, I agree. I think when you go out and take these auditions, like trying to please an entire panel, like really trying to get in their head, like, okay, what do they want? I think it's a little bit of a fool's errand, because first of all, even if you think you know what they want, you don't really know what they're looking for. So I think it's more important to be yourself, like you said, and bring what you have to say to the table. And hopefully that's something that they're interested in buying, you know?
Yeah. All right. Got some rapid fire questions for you, Vanessa. You ready?
No.
You excited?
No.
No? Okay. Advice to your 18-year-old self.
Other people care about your experience and what you're going through.
I love that.
Usually people say the opposite of that, don't they?
Really?
You just ruined her advice.
No. I like that, because most people say the opposite. Like, no one cares about what you think. Like, and it, like people are negative Nancys, you know?
That's just you, Nick.
Maybe I'm a negative Nancy.
No, I'm just saying no one cares what you think.
That's true.
number two. favorite. This is a new one, Nick. Favorite method or etude book.
Oh, God. I hate studies. If I have to pick one.
There isn't one that you don't hate. Like, if you had to go to an island and bring your trombone, you only get one book to bring.
I don't know. I'd probably like make my own and pick and choose.
What about a sassy one like Boutry or like Biche?
I like the Biche etudes. Sure. I like the flaws of it. I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not a big, you know how I don't like practicing? I also don't like studies, but I.
What a show off answer though. Like, oh, I'll just make my own book.
Well, not that I would write my own studies, that I would just take like one from this book and one from that book and pick and choose. I couldn't live with just one.
So like the Voxman. The Voxman is a compilation of different etude books. You could have
I would use the Voxman for like kindling, like on the island to like.
Oh, I'm not saying the Voxman is good. I'm saying that we could have the Frelick now, which is a compilation of etudes that she likes.
Have you guys ever been given a box of music by like some weekend warrior who finally is decided they're never going to look at all that music again?
No.
Like, more or less.
Oh, that happens to me all the time. People just give me like a whole box of
maybe, you know what it is?
There's some really bad stuff in there.
You know what it is? You put out into the world that you hate etudes, and so the world gives you etudes.
Like, I've got this pile to sort right here of like super old. Oh my god. That I still haven't got through. I just keep moving around with it to different apartments.
Let's just have a big giveaway on the Trombone Retreat Instagram, and Vanessa will autograph each one.
Yeah. What do you think?
Sure.
Encircle your favorite etude from each book, meaning that you actually have to go through it.
That would be good for me, actually. You just didn't think a very good person to ask it to. It was a great question.
No, but your thoughts and opinions matter. Remember?
Yeah.
Favorite musical experience or most meaningful musical experience that sticks out?
Well, I feel like they're all meaningful.
Aww.
They're not all meaningful. Some of them really, like Foray Requiem.
I was literally just going to say that.
I mean, when I was at Juilliard, I got to play Mahler 5 at Carnegie Hall. That was a pretty big moment. You know, anytime I get to play with my dad feels really cool. Like, he played on that recital that really was a game changer for me in second year. I got together this, like, all-star trombone quartet that, like, my dad was on.
Awesome. That's so cool.
Like, the best bass trombone guy in school. And it was, like, you know, probably one of my most memorable musical experiences of my career was recording the Fleur-de-Lis quartet album with the St. Louis trombone quartet. That was something I'm really proud of and probably the most in shape I've ever been in my life.
Also. Right. You can't hide in a quartet. That's some heavy stuff. And you guys have a Canadian trombone quartet now, right?
Yeah. The Canadian Trombone Quartet is its name.
wait, how'd you come up with it?
Well, actually,
based
it's all female trombonists. And so we went through a bunch of like really inappropriate female themes.
You didn't want to call it the Female Canadian Trombone Quartet.
You know, never mind. I can't say it. and then we're like, why not just call it? I can't even remember all of the inappropriate names we came up with. We had one night. We're trying to pick a name for a group or a CD is just the hardest thing I find. But we're like, well, there's not a Canadian Trombone Quartet. Let's just be the Canadian Trombone Quartet. And we won't mention that we're all women. And that won't be the focal point.
Who's in the whole group?
Megan Hodge, Hillary Sims, and Isabelle Lavoie on bass.
Great.
So we had one recital in January of 2020, and we've now taken a break.
Well, I look forward to some recordings.
Yeah.
Another new question. I wrote this down after a lot of drinks one night when I was being very introspective. I'm like, I want to ask every guest this, and I didn't remember it until this morning. So, Vanessa, what does success mean to you?
Well, I think for me personally, like the word content comes to mind, like just getting to a place where I feel content with like where I am on my journey. So not that I'm where I want to be, but just being okay with where I am at with my journey as it pertains to trombone, my personal life, my other life goals. I'd feel pretty successful if that were the case.
Is it the case?
Getting there.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Content in the process. I like it.
That's all we can hope for. Mm-hmm. What is something that trombonists in particular don't do enough of and can do more of?
Trombonists in particular? I don't know. We're pretty perfect creatures.
You should be a politician, Vanessa. Every question we ask you is just like, everybody's great.
I don't, exercise?
That's a new one.
I think physical fitness is pretty important to playing the trombone. And a lot of people sideline that because like I gotta get one more hour practice. It's like maybe just go do some yoga or go for a run, and I think it'll help your playing and your mental game as much as another hour of practice.
That's a new one. I liked it.
Have you been finding ways to do it during the pandemic?
Cross-country skiing.
I actually just issued a February running challenge just on Facebook, and then I had such a great response that I started a private group. And so people have just been, the goal is to do 4 runs or walks a week and post a, like either a picture from your running app or a selfie of you doing it. And everyone gives each other kudos. We've got some other trombone players on there. Donna Parks is on there. Chris Van Hoff is on there. So
have you heard of, there's like these, I don't want to say negative accountability apps, but it sort of is. I have colleagues who do this for different things like meditation or yoga or running or things like that, where you have a accountability partner. But what you do when you sign up is you sign up for causes or charities that you hate and would never want to donate to. And if you don't meet your goals, you put in like $50 and that money goes to like, so my friend chose Donald Trump for president fund. This was like in 2017, and yeah, so of course he never missed his goal.
Yeah, that would be a great motivator, yeah, for sure.
It comes from a positive and negative place. Very interesting.
Actually, but like that accountability thing brings up a good point, because I've actually wished over the years that brass players get to have a coach like vocalists do. Like, singers have coaches their entire careers, and their even just like their piano players act as coaches to them, from what I understand. I don't know lot about it.
My wife is a vocal coach originally.
Yeah. Why don't we have more brass coaches? Like, I've gone through some playing issues in the past few years, and there were times where practicing was such a slog because it just didn't sound how I wanted it to sound, didn't feel great. And at those times, I've wished that there's like somebody I could hire to just keep me accountable in my practicing.
And seriously, why not? I thought about that too. Yeah, like what if like someone could say, like Vanessa Fralick's going to come in and be like, okay, today we're going to work out this book, this book, this book. We're going to do this for 10 minutes, this for 10 minutes, blah, blah, blah. And just like plan out everything for you.
Yeah.
Maybe you have to submit recordings to you, or like.
I think it's like a so field effective. That nobody's like, it's just a job for somebody that's waiting. And even just motivation.
Right,
like,
of course.
It's kind of crazy that we're all out here on our own just trying to motivate ourselves to do this every day, and you're not always sure if you're doing it right. And especially during COVID, like there should be somebody filling this gap, I think.
Well, I think you have to change the culture, right? Like the culture is like of musicians being like, well, I'm a professional. Why would I need to go get like more training or like accountability or anything like that? But if you change it where like it becomes like the norm, like it is for singers, then it's like, okay, like, well, it's like, I'm working on this. I'm having some trouble. Let me go check in with X, Y, and Z, you know?
But I think of it, it's more of a feeling of like, I should be ready. Like I'm done school. Okay. I should be able to do this on my own. Not like an ego thing where it's like, I can do this on my own. I think actually most people just are like, I think I'm supposed to be
right,
ready to be a professional. And if there was more of a constant like, no, you still, it's okay to still need coaching, to still need some help getting motivated, staying focused, checking in, that would be so helpful for a lot of people's careers. I think I agree.
Well,
in that regard, Vanessa, we would definitely like to officially invite you to the trombone retreat practice hang, which happens Monday through Friday for an hour, where we just basically, it's actually happening in about 20 minutes, we just get on Zoom and put it on mute. And a bunch of people show up and we just chat, but we're all practicing the whole time. And it's for Nick and I, it's been awesome.
That's,
I mean,
cool.
It's been really fun.
Something to show up for.
That sounds great.
And if people are having specific issues or like, hey, how do you work on double tonguing scales? Or how do you work on X, Y, or Z? I think it's been helpful for students and professionals alike. We've had a number of professionals show up. It's been fun. So
yeah, that sounds great.
Join us sometime.
So you're invited.
Everybody's invited.
Do you hear that, everybody? Vanessa's going to be there every day. So please come and you can see Vanessa practice her etudes that she loves.
Maybe
so much.
Yeah, you can practice while cross country skiing. Bring a P-bone or something.
That would get.
I'll pass.
Yeah, exactly.
That sounds difficult.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, thanks for hanging out with us, Vanessa. It's good to see
me.
You at least. Of course. Yeah. Absolutely. It's good to see you virtually at least. And hopefully we'll get to hang out in person sometime and actually play the trombone together at some point. But best of luck with everything going on and bigger and brighter ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe,
hope so for all of us.
Maybe we can go skiing again in Utah at some point.
Oh, the powder.
Yeah.
Fresh pow-pow.
So good.
Yeah.
All of our, I think we're like the only place in the world ski hills are closed down. You can't even go skiing
because of COVID
on the little hills that we do have.
Oh,
but you have Tim Hortons though.
Ugh, I despise Tim Hortons.
What?
Did you know another fun fact about St. Catharines, Ontario, is the place Tim Horton died?
You mean when he was drunk driving and crashed his car? Yeah, he's a horrible person that there should not be a chain of restaurants named after.
Oh, man. Oh, we saved the juicy stuff for the closing. I love it.
Wow, I didn't realize Tim Hortons was a trigger for Vanessa.
I don't know anything about him other than he was like a hockey player at one point.
Yeah, apparently he was not such a great guy. And he was drunk driving when he died.
Which is not
good. See, now, do they call it drunk driving in Canada or is it drink driving? Because Is it different English speaking countries call different things? You guys have different words for things than we do?
I think as far as drinking is concerned, we just keep it simple.
Because in England and Australia, they do say drink driving.
Really? Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't even know that.
Wow. Yeah. Thanks, Nick.
Now you know.
For that nugget of wisdom.
Well, you know what, Sebastian? All right. You can go back to Texas, all right, and remember your freaking Alamo.
Oh, man. At least someone does.
I did the tour.
It's not really that awesome.
Okay. Davy Crockett's rolling over in his grave.
I was, loyalist. I come from loyalist background.
Ah.
Another fun fact about St. Catharines, Ontario that I learned today. It was one of the final...
settled.
Is it really?
Yes.
Is that what you were going to say?
Well,
her church was right around the corner from my house.
No kidding.
That's very cool. And also it was one of the final stops on the Underground Railroad.
Makes sense if she was there. Yeah.
That's where she brought her parents to.
Yeah, get out of America. That's probably a good idea.
Mm-hmm. But then she went back to New York. Oh. Well, she had her young boyfriend she had to get back to.
Oh, my.
You are just full of history. I love it.
Random things.
Me too.
Harriet Tubman should be on the $20 bill or whatever they're about to replace. I just want more Freilich hot takes.
Yeah, I'm all for it.
Cool. You heard it here. All right. Well, if you ever need any other facts about your hometown, just let me know.
Okay. Can you give me one more?
Oh, man.
Just to end the call. Oh.
Oh, jeez. I was like maxed out.
You were bluffing.
I totally was. I'm going to put this on Wikipedia. It's the birthplace of Vanessa Freilich. Fun fact.
Well, I did. It does have like significant people born there, and you were not. Oh, Neil Peart.
Oh.
That's one,
he was born
one
there?
Of the big guys. I believe so. Oh. I believe I read that.
I think it was the first city in North America to have streetcars.
Whoa.
Maybe?
Well,
or fourth city?
I imagine it was...
first or fourth.
Now we're just making stuff up. They also invented oatmeal. I don't know if you knew.
The steel cup.
I imagine, just on a side note, that it was also one of the first cities in North America to have electricity because of the falls. Because Buffalo was like the first like fully electric city, right?
Maybe. It was booming.
It was
boom. Boomtown.
I'm sure it was.
It's also spelled with two A's. Catharines. Okay.
Okay.
Well, I'll let you guys.
It's the longest goodbye ever.
Good luck in your committee stuff. That's tough business. I was on a committee for a while.
Yeah, I'm the chair of the artistic committee right now.
You're just like more trombone concertos, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't. It's kind of ironic that the trombonist is the chair of the artistic committee, really.
Yeah, I would say it's perfect.
Yeah.
I'll try.
What you have to say is valuable, Vanessa.
Thank you. I needed to hear that like 20 years ago.
Where were you, Sebastian? Where were you? Well, I think we cleared something up, Sebastian. You know what it is?
What?
Freilich, not frolic.
Yeah, I mean, I could see, because frolic sounds more, I imagine it's a German word, I forgot to ask, but if it's German, I would think it's frolic.
You're better.
It's very good.
Yeah,
very good.
That BV sound that they get in Spanish. Yeah, good chat. I enjoyed it, and I've always enjoyed Vanessa. I've known her for a while, and she's a model of success.
Yeah, she has a kick-ass resume, and she's just really applied herself, and she's just a fantastic player, obviously. Definitely check her out. There's some good recordings on YouTube, and of course, that St. Louis recording is really, really awesome. But I really liked what she was talking about. You know, growing up, she just followed loving music, but being inspired by that great teacher to really set goals and set specific goals, I thought it was really interesting, and it kind of goes along the lines of believing something is possible, like when she was talking about writing her name on the roster of the Toronto Symphony before the audition. It's like a way to really go a step further than visualization and just accept that it's a possibility. And in a way, it like kind of takes away nerves, right?
Yeah, it's like the truest essence of what a vision board is, you know? It's like if you boil that down to its essence, that's what she did. And it was, it's pretty cool that she has that story, you know?
Yeah, and you would think, you know, you could look at it a couple different ways, because we worry about, if we make such a specific goal, and we don't reach it, is that setting us up for being really disappointed? And I don't think she necessarily looks at it that way, but it just really helps. I think she would be happy if she wasn't in the Toronto Symphony Orchestra and still won another job. But I think just believing in yourself that much, I think it is really cool and a really focused way of doing it. I think that's really interesting. Me personally, and you had some really good ideas about tiered goals, you know, looking at goals as like a step to another goal to a step to another goal.
Yeah, I was going to mention that Nikki Abissi turned me on to something called SMART goals, and it's not her thing. She just hit me to it, and it's an acronym. It's specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and time-based. So if you take each one of those, you know, say like, I want to, within a year, be able to play the row parts or something like that, you know? And so then you go from there and you have checkpoints along the way to that goal, and you make sure it's a goal that's achievable from where you are right now in your playing. And then the time-based obviously is, you know, you set a time frame. I think it's a smart way of going, about things. And I've tried to implement this with my students, even using the acronym itself or just the idea of it, and having students not just say, oh, be better at the trombone. Well, that's not specific enough. You know, we have specific goals that you want to reach. Like Vanessa, I want to play trombone in Boston or Toronto. Hey, look, she did it. So it's pretty cool.
That's cool. Yeah, somewhat related, the way I kind of look at goals is a slightly different thing. I was really inspired by this article I read once, and I can definitely dig it up for anyone that's curious. But it's less about having a specific goal and more about, and this is in line with kind of how I feel about, you know, meditation and trying to be present in everything you do. And it's more about having a system, and it's more about the things you do every day and building something as part of your identity. That if you just try to accomplish all these things every day, these results are going to come. And of course, kind of have a target or something you're aiming towards, but like things like knowing the things that always make you feel good and help you improve. Like, okay, I know my system is going to include, I'm going to work out for 30 minutes a day. I'm going to meditate. I'm going to eat at this specific time. I'm going to warm up at this specific time. I'm going to record myself. I'm going to like, build your own system and just make that a repeatable thing that just becomes part of your identity, and only good things come from that.
Yeah. I mean, one could call that a routine, but it's kind of like a life routine rather than just a trombone routine.
Yeah. So something else that she brought up that I think we all definitely identify with, especially us that have spent a significant amount of time in New York City, is dealing with neighbors and trombone players. Turns out it's not the quietest instrument.
What?
And there's things that we have to practice sometimes that are loud, and neighbors don't always love it, unfortunately. And a lot of people who have been through situations like this can identify, but it's such a nuanced thing. It comes down to person, of course, but there's ways that you can at least try to minimize these altercations, I found. I mean, have you had direct experiences like this?
You know, I've been pretty lucky, but my first apartment in New York, I was living with Kyle Covington, who's principal trombonist in the San Diego Symphony. Shout out to Kyle, one of my really close friends. And we generally practiced at school because we were walking distance to school. But sometimes, like, for various reasons, we'd practice at home, but very rarely. And every single time we did, it would be during the week, and it would be during normal hours, you know, 2 p.m. or something like that. And every time this guy who was across the air shaft from us would come and knock on our door and say, you know, I work nights. Can you keep it down? And so we'd put in a practice mute. This went on for a year and a half. And one time he comes over, knocks on the door, and I put in a practice mute, and he comes back. There's a knock on the door like 2 minutes later. And I was like, what now? There's no way he can hear me. I have a practice mute. And I open the door, and he has a CD. And he says, you know, I feel really bad. I'm always bothering you because you're bothering me. And I just, like, I kind of want to give you this as a olive branch, you know, say that I'm not trying to be mean. I'm just sensitive. And it was a Bob Brookmeyer CD.
Wow.
I was like, how do you know Bob Brookmeyer? And he goes, well, actually, I make a living as a jazz guitarist.
What?
And so this backfired on him. And I said, you of all people have to know that I have to practice. Like, that's unbelievable that you'd come. I didn't know you were a musician. And I said, we don't have the benefit of unplugging our instrument like you do. And you can just play quietly. You don't have to be amplified. Or you could wear headphones. And I said, do me a favor. Don't come back here anymore. And one time I was
practicing. You said that?
Yeah. And so one afternoon he comes and knocks on the door. I look through the peephole and I said, I'm not stopping. I have my right to practice. And he said, well, then I'm calling the cops. And I said, go ahead. They're not going to come. I mean, a noise complaint at 2 in the afternoon. They're not going to show up for that because it's within your rights. So that leads me to know your rights. You know, the cities, most cities, at least in North America, have tenant rights. And they protect musicians, what they call reasonable noises during these hours. And some buildings have specific, like if you're in a co-op or something like that, have specific rules that are unique to that building. But generally, the city or the state have rules that protect you, laws that protect you, not just rules.
Yeah, and obviously, you don't want it to have to come to that. But you want to know what you have in your corner. And in my opinion, the best thing you could do is kind of be direct with it. And if you move to a new place or if you have a new neighbor, knock on the door, introduce yourself, show that you're a human, and just be like, hey, I'm a professional musician and I have to practice for my job. And just let me know if it's ever too much. And sometimes saying that just humanizes yourself a little bit and makes them a little bit more understanding. And there's always ways you can compromise. And if you get to know like their work schedule, you know, you could be lucky in certain things. And there's, of course, you know, you could talk about things you can do acoustically to treat your walls or floors. Often, you know, lower sounds penetrate walls more so, and they often go vertically in buildings rather than to the sides, like a lot of people think. So putting down rugs helps a lot. But it makes me think of a story once when I was living with my ex-girlfriend in New York City. One time, the neighbor came and knocked on the door, and we opened the door, and you're always a little nervous when you don't recognize the person, and they're like, my ex-girlfriend was a pianist, and she knocked on the door, and she was like, are you the pianist? Are you the one that's practicing all the time? And we were like, oh, yeah. I'm sorry if it's loud. And she's like, she pulls a bottle of wine from behind her back. And she's just like, I just want you to know that me and my family listen to you every night. And it's just so beautiful.
Aww.
Which was like amazing. It was just like one of those amazing New York moments. And of course, you're like, no one would ever bring me a bottle of wine for playing trombone.
No. Well, I once was practicing the off a Clyde. I know this is a trombone podcast, but I do every now and then play the off a Clyde and
trombone adjacent.
It's like the black sheep of the brass family. So I was practicing it and there's a knock on the door. It's probably like 7 at night and I'm like, uh-oh, here we go. But like also like the off a Clyde's not very loud. So I was like, who's complaining about the off a Clyde besides Sarah? It's a terrible instrument besides that. And this woman, she says, I have a weird question for you. I'm in a photography class and my assignment for the week is to take a picture of a neighbor in their home environment. Can I take pictures of you practicing?
And you started taking your clothes off.
I was like, I know this routine. Button, button, button. Yeah. Cinemax.
Me like one of your French girls.
Yeah. And so I didn't want her to take pictures of me with off clad. So I put that down and pulled out my trombone and she took pictures. And a couple weeks later, she developed them professionally. And I still have some of them. They're really cool. She did them both in color and in black and white. And that was also a great New York neighbor moment. But unfortunately, I know too many people that have had just horrible experiences and have had to move. Like Vanessa said, she had to move, you know, just because it becomes unbearable, you know?
It would have been really cool to have some weird headshots of you holding an off a Clyde.
Yeah, in retrospect, I probably should have done it, you know? It'd be very, like, kind of steampunk.
Yeah.
Like Williamsburg.
So what do you do for a living? I play the Alpha Clyde in a spoken word trio. You can see this at the coffee shop.
It's a jaw harp, an Alpha Clyde, and a dulcimer.
We play 70s Christian contemporary music.
I love it, dude.
Ironic.
Oh, man. I kind of want to do that now.
I've always had like an idea of having like a genre wheel spinner. Like you just spin the wheel and it'll just match up with like a random genre of music and a random like instrumentation. And you just create that band.
Ooh, the hurdy-gurdy. It's always a good one.
Nothing. And if you enjoy the hurdy-gurdy and or this podcast, please consider leaving us a rating and review on iTunes. If you want to leave a question or a topic you'd like us to discuss, we'll answer it on the podcast. Follow us at Trombone Retreat on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and our website, tromboneretreat.com, where you can also join our mailing list. Also, subscribe to our new YouTube channel. We're also now offering online trombone lessons, so visit tromboneretreat.com/lessons for more information. And feel free to shoot us an email at tromboneretreat@gmail.com, as we love hearing from you. Thank you so much to everyone that has been reaching out. We get so many emails each week, and it really makes our day to wake up to these. On Instagram, follow Nick at basstrombone444 and myself at js.vera. And as always, never forget.
Retreat yourself.
Please stand clear of the doors. The next station is Dundas Station.